Hey folks, this is Philip with the Everyday Fighter Podcast, where we share stories and insights from everyday fighters just like you. Today I'm speaking with Bill Kipp. Bill is a former Marine. He is also a veteran martial artist, having 40 years of experience in various martial arts. He's also the founder of the Fast Defense System, which is a system that is based on adrenal stress self-defense, where he taught people of all backgrounds, children, educators, military, and law enforcement, to use fear and the adrenal response that comes with it as a friend, as opposed to something that is to be avoided or compartmentalized. Bill goes into his upbringing and growing up, being bullied as a child by somebody very, very close to him, how that affected him growing up, and how it put him on a search for something that could help him to overcome the trauma that he experienced as a child. So I'm looking forward to sharing my conversation with him. But before I do that, I wanted to jump into our episode spotlight. As a reminder, these spotlights are unsponsored. These people have no idea who I am for the most part. They definitely don't have an idea that I'm doing this. But once in a while, I'll run into individuals or organizations that I feel are just doing good work in the world, and I just want to put a bit of a spotlight on them, get them some more attention. And today I wanted to talk about Rishi Sharma and his organization, the Heroes of the Second World War. As a high school student, Rishi learned about World War II and the generation of men and women that went off to fight for our freedoms. And he was just obsessed with that mindset and the sacrifice that they made on our behalf. So he said he put it upon himself to go out and speak to these men and women before it was too late, because so many of them are dying every single day, and he didn't want to lose the experience and the history that would go along with their passing. So he just travels the country now, speaking to these veterans about their experiences in the war, and he puts them online to share with the world. So I was just really inspired by Rishi's story and his motivation, and I just wanted to put some more attention on what he's doing in his mission. If you want to learn more about Heroes of the Second World War, just go to their website, heroesofthesecondworldwar.org, and you can get more information there. That's it for our spotlight. Let's jump into my interview with Bill Kipp.
I grew up in Connecticut, small town in Connecticut, and had a bit of bullying when I actually had a good bit of bullying when I was growing up, and it really impacted me. You know, I was very young at that age, and the impact that it had on me was that it caused me to have this, you know, kind of terror of conflict, you know, so that even if I was standing next to kids yelling or something, I would get that freeze response because of what had happened to me in my bullying. It hit me pretty hard. So unbeknownst to me, that became a driver in my life to where I just decided I'm never going to be a victim again. You know, it's just that that switch that happens when the kid being bullied just says no more. And it wasn't even a conscious thing. It was just that, you know, this really sucks and I don't want to get beat up or bullied anymore. And so it was a driver. I felt fear, but like a lot of guys, I learned all these ways to kind of hide that fear, you know? And so, cause I didn't know any other way to deal with it in a real way. I was just surviving and trying to deal with life. So, so I did what a lot of guys do. I was real good in sports, lifted weights. I did martial arts. I was captain of my lacrosse team, you know, all these things to try to prove that I'm not afraid, you know, that I'm tougher than that. Huh. But inside there was still this fear. There was this scared little kid inside that, and again, I wasn't aware of it at that point, but it was there. So anyway, long story short is I ended up joining the Marine Corps, again, as a way to prove myself. And the Marines weren't enough, so I had to join the Marine Reconnaissance, the Special Ops Unit, and I had a great time. It was really good for me to get in there. I think I did find a lot of true confidence. We did some amazing training. It was after Vietnam. Nobody shot at me. I didn't shoot anyone else. So I just got to travel around the world and do some of the best training that was available at that time. And it had a good, powerful impact on me to kind of to take back my power that had been taken from me as a kid. I think that's what happens to kids that are bullied. Our power gets taken away, and then it becomes this long journey, or mine was, to try to rekindle that confidence. And the Marine Corps helped, although we didn't have the technology that we have now, even in the special ops, to really learn how to deal with the adrenaline and stress. But we did the best we could. We had the best training there was available, and it was a good time. Anyway, so I got out of the Marine Corps and lived in California as a commercial diver for a couple of years. Decided there was something missing in my life, and I wanted to do more martial arts. So I had been to the Philippines a number of times. We were based out of there in quite a bit of my military excursions, and I moved to the Philippines. An old recon buddy and I bought one-way tickets, moved to Manila, and there we were. And I hooked up with a guy, started learning the Filipino martial arts, and did that. I lasted for 2 years. And then things were getting a little bit hostile. This is way back in the day when Ferdinand Marcos was in power, and things got pretty ugly there. And the sentiment towards Americans was turning. Mm-hmm. And so when I had a few incidents in Manila where shots were being fired and a guy swung a baseball bat at my head, I decided it's probably a pretty good time to leave and go back to America. And that's when I came back to the States and moved to Colorado. And I was teaching Filipino martial arts on a kind of part-time basis, just to keep involved with it. And then I came across this self-defense program somebody mentioned this demo that was happening, and I went, oh boy, another self-defense course, because with the training I had and all, I never had much faith in your traditional self-defense. It just, for me, it never gave me the confidence that I was looking for. You know, I think the martial arts are great, but that fear component, that when you're, you know, when you feel like you're going to die, that I never got to really experience that and make friends with that, if you will, in all my training, even in the military special ops, because nobody shot at us, it was in a training mode. So anyways, this self-defense course, the guy said, no, these guys put on these big suits and they teach the students real simple stuff, and the students just kick the crap out of the guy. And I had to admit that sounded pretty cool. That wasn't anything that I had experienced in my training. And so anyway, long story short again, is we quit class early that day and went and watched a demonstration of this self-defense course. And it was back then, it was called Model Mugging. It was a program that was started in 1972 by a guy named Matt Thomas, who was a former special ops guy and a longtime martial artist. He created the system, and that's what the system was. And I watched it, and I think what really intrigued me was, one, the students were taught awareness skills of the whole predator-prey dynamics, how not to be an easy victim, how to convey, how to communicate in a positive, assertive way so that you're not an easy victim. And then, verbal skills to be able to de-escalate the situation if you can, which in my experience, most can. I saw that and went, holy crap, what a concept. You know, from my days of fighting, it was like, well, you're either standing there having a beer with someone or you're fighting. There was nothing in between. And so there was this huge world of self-defense that opened up to me when I saw this. I thought, what a great concept. This is really what I was looking for my whole life, to try to deal with that, with the real life situations that come up. And then the key thing was that they taught the students how to flip their switch, how to use their adrenaline as their jet fuel to fight if they have to. And, you know, the idea being that in a fight, oftentimes the crazier person wins. And so, you know, so it's, so they were teaching people that their adrenaline and their fear that I had learned as a negative from such an early age and really was kind of running from for you know, for decades, that it's actually our best friend because it's our jet fuel to help us fight for our lives if we ever need it. And so, so I saw this demonstration, and of course the way they did it was they were tapping into their adrenaline. They taught them karate 101, just palm strikes, elbows, you know, simple stuff, knees to the groin, but they were doing it against these guys in this big old ugly looking armor, but it was really, you know, they were just unleashing their beasts in a way that I had never done in all my training. We, you know, in the Marine Corps, we trained real hard.
Okay.
What we called our recon fu. You know, we'd get in there and we'd beat the hell out of each other, but not to this level because it wasn't that survival sense. And so they were getting these students into that absolute, holy crap, this feels real, and that full on survival response, so that they can learn how to use their adrenaline. But for me and for most many people, it's our worst enemy because it can, the negative effects of adrenaline can keep us from responding appropriately or responding at all. And but when you use that adrenaline, when you flip that switch, you're forced to be reckoned with. So the analogy I like to use is try to hold on to a cat who doesn't want to be held, you know, and who wins that battle every single time. And, you know, when that cat's totally adrenalized and you know, it may just have a, it's not thinking claw number three on pressure point number four. It's thinking, you better let go, I'm going to rip your arm off. You know, that's the mindset that they were getting these students. So in a nutshell, it was like, do whatever you can to not fight. But if you've got to fight, flip your switch and do whatever you can to fight for your life. So I thought, you know, again, this was pretty cool stuff. And I got involved as an instructor, and that started my whole journey into this adrenal stress response training that was, well, it's been 30 years now since I've been in it.
Wow. Bill, there's so many places I want to go with this. It's crazy. I love that you have like all this experience and everything, but like, I want to go back though. I mean, the first thing you talked about was like just that being bullied as a child, and how much that affected you all the way through, like even decades later.
Even today.
So, well, what was that like? Was it such that were you just like a small kid and like maybe an easy target? What did they feel that you deserved it in some way, or you just happened to be, hey, they're around? What was the context around that?
Yeah, the context for the bullying, well, it was, part of it was family. I had an older brother who was 6 years older and had a chip on his shoulder, and I was the convenient one to take it out on. And then I think what happened was from the beatings from my brother, it just caused me to really withdraw. And so other kids would read that, and it's the predator prey, you know, dynamic. Other bullies would see that, and then they would come and pick on me. So I kind of became I was much smaller and younger than my brother, who was the initial taunter. You know, and then after that, it became a pattern, a negative pattern that, whenever I would, now I see it, it's post-traumatic stress, that when the kids would come up to me, even though, and again, even as I got older and I was good in sports and all, I still had that hardwired response from the bullying from my earlier childhood, because it doesn't go away until you, and this is the beauty of adrenal stress response training, until you recondition new neurosynapses and new responses in that, you know, in the high stress situation.
Right.
But that was it. It was just, you know, I was just a much smaller kid. He was much bigger and stronger, and I didn't have a choice.
I think even like multiplies the challenge there is that this is somebody that is in your household, you know, like where some people talk about, like, they're getting bullied at school, they're getting bullied outside or whatever. Maybe they have a break when they get home, but that didn't sound like that was the case for you.
Yeah, there was nowhere to hide. I remember that first time, the very first, you know, it's funny what sticks in your mind. But the first beating I had, I remember graphically, afterwards I was done, I went to my mom and I just tried to tell her, and she had five kids, you know, and this was back in the 60s, and you know, she didn't know what to do. And she just said, well, just stay away from him. And there was no resolution. And so she didn't know what to do. Nobody really knew what to do at that point. And so from that point on, from that one little moment, I just went inside, go, well, I guess it's up to me. I'm going to have to figure this out one way or the other. And so it began.
And you ended up withdrawing quite a bit after. That was kind of,
I did. And it's kind of sad because I was a really outgoing young kid. even at 4 or 5 years old. And sorry, my dog is here. So,
no worries.
You know, but yeah, I did. I mean, for sure. I learned how to project that I was cool and confident, but it was a cocky bravado. It wasn't real. Mm-hmm. I still had this hardwired sense of kind of victim mode in me that was hardwired into me from the beatings.
Mm. And it's interesting because you were talking about even later on, you're talking about adrenal stress response. Like you had the adrenaline even back then, but just not necessarily knowing how to channel that or where to go with it. As well, right?
Yeah, man, I think that's such a crucial thing that most of us have experienced the adrenaline rush at one point or another. And oftentimes it doesn't go well. And so what happens is we create a negative association to that adrenaline. We think it's a bad thing. And we don't realize that, nobody ever taught me that fear was a good thing. We wouldn't be alive as a species. No species would be alive if there wasn't fear to say, hey, something's wrong. We need to respond here.
Right.
So I had that negative connotation, negative association. And, so whenever fear, and it became kind of a double whammy, whenever fear came up, and it's going to come up, it comes up for all of us, what happens is I would have that internal response, so I would do kind of internally freeze, but then my brain would come in and go, wow, you're really, there's something wrong with you. Because this fear is, you're not supposed to be afraid. All the conditioning that we get around fear, that's really not necessarily accurate at all about, just suck it up. It's you'll get over it. Well, when you're in that mode, it can be debilitating, to that extent. But the point being is that, that fear and adrenaline happen to us as if it happens at a negative, in a negative situation, even at a young age, you hear about people who are kind of the proverbial victim. They just continue to get into situations and things happen to them and wonder what's wrong with you. Well, most likely, in my experience, when I talk to them and find out what their history is, usually there was an incident or incidents in the past where they got adrenalized, they got overcome, they froze. And then something bad happened to them. And then that gets hardwired. The whole science of the brain gets hardwired into us, into the amygdala. So that in subsequent years, when you get into that fear state, that will be your default mode to go to. If someone froze as a child, they'll likely continue to freeze as they grow older. And conversely, if someone's a hothead, it's not like they were born that way. Sure. They had experiences as a kid, because we're all born as blank slates. They had experiences at some point in their life where they got adrenalized, they had an aggressive response for whatever reason, and then that gets hardwired into their amygdala so that when they get triggered in years later, that will tend to be their default mode to jump into.
Now for you, when you look back on that time, is there something that you can pinpoint or like, because you, to your point, The first few times you get adrenalized, then you typically have a choice, one way or the other. Sometimes people freeze, but you can go fight or freeze or, or flee, right? But you kind of froze and you kind of went into yourself. Was that because of what you were learning from school or parents or what, that fighting back or just fighting in general is not a good thing? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you mentioned that it's a choice, and I think for me it wasn't a choice because, like, I was 4 years old, and my original tormentor was 10, so I had no choice. I did try. The first beating, he was beating on me. I got up. I tried to outrun him.
Yeah.
He just caught me, beat me even harder. I tried to fight back. He fought me even harder. So what happened was, I remember the moment it happened in my brain. I just said, "Well, you just got to curl up in a ball and take it." And so for me, that was what got hardwired into my, into my being as my default mode. And then the double whammy came on later when watching Bruce Lee, watching Chuck Bronson. I'm dating myself on movies now, to see back then there were Clint Eastwood, these cool, these guys who just cool as ice. They weren't afraid, and so. Then I would feel the fear, and that would be the double whammy. Well, then, these guys aren't afraid. I'm afraid, so something must be wrong with me. And so is that double whammy that, that hit me. Yeah.
That's just huge right there. My goodness.
Yeah, well, it becomes quite a driver for, you know, it wasn't my life, unbeknownst to me, to go, well, something's got to change here, but not knowing really how to do anything about it. Mm. Surviving is the best we can.
Mm. Especially if it's such that the people that are around you, they haven't had to experience that themselves, or like maybe it's not even a kind of something that is openly discussed, you know, particularly back then. I think these days there's more of a conversation around people's feelings and trauma and that type of thing. But, you know, aside from you feeling that, you know, feeling these challenges, like if there's nobody around you, you can see like, okay, I can go to this person, then that's even worse, right?
Yeah. And in truth, I think still the whole adrenal stress phenomena is misunderstood, kind of underrated, but certainly back then relatively it was the dark ages where, yeah, there was nowhere to hide.
You mentioned some of the other things though, that you went to, and from anybody that is listening to that from the outside in, they're saying, oh, wow, you know, he's the captain of the lacrosse team. He's excelling in sports and getting into martial arts and this and that. He's a confident dude, you know, it's like no one can take that away from you. But that was something, I mean, I don't know if you knew it back then, if that was just more of a shell or that you had to create, or that's something that you found later. But did you feel like you needed to do these things? Was it a conscious decision that I need to put these things out in front of me, that I excel in these areas to hide that kind of hurt person, that hurt boy that was still there inside of you?
That's a great question as to, you know, how much conscious thought went into the whole strategy. I don't think there was much. I think I was just driven, almost amoeba-like, just driven by the forces of nature. I think I'm athletic. So that was, that helped. That steered me more towards athletics, towards sports. You know, the competition thing, lifted weights, you know, and again, I think time, we're the time period, also where you live, you know, we're all a bunch of, we're trying to be tough kids. And so that's the way I went, that, you know, it was my only way to survive. I think some people, I guess, to look at the, you know, when people get triggered like that, they can go a couple of ways. One way is to get real aggressive, and one way would be get real passive. You know, where you see like a lot of sexual abuse victims will gain a lot of weight as a defense mechanism, to try not to draw them, you know, and then other people will go that aggressive way. And that's the way that I went. I think a big part of it is gender, although absolutely not exclusively, because I've trained a lot of women who are pretty pissed off and were pretty aggressive. But I think, you know, I think you can make some generalizations that men tend to go more aggressive, women tend to go more passive. But as far as a conscious strategy, I don't think so. I think I was just trying to survive any way that I could.
Because even like, you know, to the point of joining the military, getting to the Marines even, and then excelling and going to higher levels in the Marines, those are pretty strong moves. I mean, not like very few people would take that. And again, like looking back on that, I'm just kind of blown away by that, and saying when you said earlier that, you know, that still didn't address the inner challenges that were still inside you.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. And I'd say, I guess, two things on that. One, don't underestimate the drivers, you know, the things that happen to us at younger ages, and how much they're, even still today, they're driving us. A lot of times we're not even conscious of it. And, there's another point I was going to make and it slipped my mind, but, yeah.
No worries.
It'll come back. Too many kicks to the head.
Well, no, I think that's it's just interesting to me, in that, because physically, absolutely, there are things that you have to go through. There are challenges that you go through, boot camp and all the things there. I mean, again, like, you know, you're going to the special recon groups, etc. Not everyone in the Marines even is doing that, right? So, so aside from the physical stuff, I mean, you've got, the assumption is, my assumption would be that you got to be strong mentally to go through that as well. But going through, you know, just based on what you're saying, going through that stuff doesn't necessarily address the things that were, it's not fixing necessarily anything that happened prior or like the internal trauma that's still going on. It's still fairly compartmentalized.
Beautiful segue to the point that I had forgotten just a few minutes ago. And that is, yeah, we do as we train. And like I said, nobody ever shot at me. We did incredible training, but it was all training. And I never, in my training, I never felt like it was a life and death situation. Whereas when I was that 4-year-old kid, it was a life. It wasn't, but it felt to me like a life and death situation. And that's the power. That's the imprinting that happens to us. And it's such a deep subconscious level. So for training, for me to learn how to deal with that life and death situation, I have to at least on pretty as close as possible simulate that same survival situation.
Yes.
So that I, you know, it really feels life or death. And it's really, there's a lot of brain science that goes into it, and we can get into it more. But
yeah,
the training that I did, it was all done. I mean, there's a safe, you know, you got to have safe safety parameters, and it's all designed to be in a controlled environment. And so even as intense as it was, it didn't go to that depth, you know, that subconscious depth of survival that happens in a real situation, I guess, you know, just like you see it over and over again. And there've been great books on combat, on killing, you know, other works as well that talk about, and even with martial arts, we can train in the safety of the dojo, but when the shit hits the fan and all of a sudden, you know, you're there in that situation, the level of your training, the depth of your training is going to show up or not. And so, yeah, even though I had the best training that was available in the world at that point, it still did not overcome that primitive freeze response because my training didn't go to that level subconsciously, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you didn't really get a realization of this until much later in your past your training and even after you left the military, as you're saying, until you went to that initial training, that adrenal response training that you saw.
Exactly.
I mean, you talk about doing like years of martial arts and that type of thing. And, you know, you can see the marketing from a lot of martial arts type places or whatever, that it's self-defense and, you know, you're going to be tested and stuff, but you know, you went through a lot of that, even going to the Philippines to train directly, you know, from, you know, quote unquote, the source there. But you still, that wasn't something that you had experienced to that level that you had experienced as a child.
Correct. And you know, and we just didn't know any better. You know, I mean, you would think in the Marine Corps Special Ops that they would have their stuff together around the adrenal stress, but they really didn't. And in subsequent training, you know, we didn't know back then. When I saw this new training, it was a complete paradigm shift because until then it was like, all I knew, like I said, was, you know, it's either you're either not fighting or you're fighting. And I didn't really know what, or why, you know, or context. I think you mentioned context earlier. Context is so crucial in self-defense. And it's so, and when we talk about self-defense in this generic term, but I mean, the context of self-defense really in real life is probably eat well and exercise.
Right. You
know? But in other contexts, you know, you just tell that to a Syrian refugee and go, well, self-defense is a whole different context. So back then we didn't have a context. All we knew was the old chop socky Bruce Lee. He didn't deal with all that crap. You know, he was either really cool, saying cool stuff, or he was kicking crap out of somebody.
Right. Dropping a one-liner every once in a while. The rest of the time, he's like kicking people.
Clint Eastwood didn't deal with all that.
Yeah, no.
And that's a great point. In fact, there might have even been some negative stigma, like, oh, that pussy stuff. You know, I don't know. But I think we just didn't know what we didn't know back then.
Well, I mean, you made a statement earlier where you talked about, you know, even back then, we didn't have the technology. And I think initially, if someone would hear that, it's more of like, okay, he's talking about weaponry, he's talking about tactics, but you're talking more so about the technology of how your brain works and how you deal with emotions and, you know, in those contexts that we were just talking about.
Right.
Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And it's the, when you get right down to it, that's that stuff, if you will, I think is more relevant to self-defense than anything else.
Mm.
Because when you look at it, the vast majority of situations that we get into, even heated altercations, physical violence is not the answer in the vast majority of those situations.
Mm.
But if we're just tuned in, if our only, you know, a carpenter only knows a hammer. Mm. If all I know is fighting, get in there and fight, well, then I'm going to lose the opportunity to steer this, to take control and steer this situation in a creative and appropriate course.
Mm.
And, you know, and again, the adrenaline kicks in and it causes people to knee jerk. And then it gets really crazy where the knee jerk responses kick in and our primary brain shuts down, our primitive amygdala takes over.
Mm.
And that's where we're not just dealing with the situation. And I guess this is the crux of, you know, this is the answer in 10,000 words or more, is that we're not, when I'm in an altercation, I'm not just dealing with that person. I'm dealing with a whole array of internal phenomena that if I can't control what's going on in here, I'm not very likely to be able to control the situation that is triggering it.
Mm, mm. So when you train for this now and help people in your courses and programs, trying to bring this feeling up in them, this kind of, in my class, I call it kind of like an oh shoot moment. Like, wow, this is like, you got to get a little bit of pitter patter in there.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
How do you, cause you talked about safety measures and all that kind of stuff as well. So there's that kind of that fine line, right? In terms of, well, you want people to feel the context of a traumatic experience, but you don't want to traumatize them,
right?
Kind of thing. How do you manage that?
Yeah, that's an important thing, because the, you know, adrenal stress training is really powerful, but it can do harm if you don't do it correctly, and you do run the threat when you're pushing someone to that level. You're running the threat of re-victimizing them if they don't, you know, if they don't have a successful response.
Mm.
So, and it's kind of a repeat of what I said before, but the technology is like this. It's really pretty simple. Just as someone like me could be in a situation where they froze as a young kid, that will be their default mode.
Mm-hmm.
Or if someone becomes aggressive, that would be their default mode. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is we're engineering a positive outcome. So we are in a defined, safe, choreographed environment. We are eliciting a little bit of adrenaline response,
mm-hmm.
but we are resourcing them ahead of time so that they can have a successful experience, so that they can learn that, oh, adrenaline actually was helpful in that situation. And then we build on that. So it's done in baby steps. And then each time, the cool thing, each time someone taps into their power in a positive way, it really strengthens their confidence.
Mm.
And each time they do it again, there's an exponential gain in their ability to deal with that adrenaline, to deal with tough situations and keep their brain online, keep present, so that they can look and find a creative solution to the problem. And if they have to, then they also have access in a positive way to all that adrenaline to unleash the dogs of war if they need. But it needs to be done. It needs to be done carefully. And what we do is we have a team. When we do a scenario, if I'm going to do a scenario with you or anyone, there would be you as a student. There would be a coach who would be on your side, and then there would be me, the aggressor. And when I say the aggressor, it's actually it's misunderstood a lot. It's a unique dual role of, yeah, I'm triggering you. Okay, I'm supposed to elicit that adrenaline response, but I'm also coaching you to success.
Mm.
People say, well, what do I mean is that you're just going to fall over? You're going to give them an easy out? It's like, no. The idea is you adrenalize someone. If they have a successful response, then that becomes then that strengthens their confidence.
Mm.
And even if it's somewhat fabricated initially, it doesn't matter. To the subconscious, they had adrenaline, they had a success, and that's a good thing.
Mm.
And so, you know, and so then again, you build on that, but it's through the both coaches, the coach behind the student kind of whispering in their ear. So when they're in the subconscious mind, when their amygdala takes over and their prefrontal cortex shuts down, they're in that fight or flight response, the coach is actually talking to them kind of like a ring man in a fight. You know, that fighter's in there, and there's hundreds and thousands of people yelling and screaming, but that fighter will hear that ring man. It's the same thing in the fight that's going on in the scenario where all of a sudden they may freeze, and that coach will say, fight, fight, or breathe. A lot of times we hold our breath, breathe, yell, you know, and all of a sudden, bang, that kicks in. And then that actually is positive conditioning. So they're getting it from the coach. And then for me, there's a lot, when I'm playing the bad guy in the suit or even in a verbal situation, people think that, well, you're just playing the goon, you know, you're the padded dummy. And really it's so much more than that. Again, you're playing that unique dual role of the aggressor, but also the coach. And I'm using biofeedback. When they do something right, I'm going to respond. When they don't do something correctly, I'm going to do something to them to try to elicit that correct response. So it's a very powerful, but I think misunderstood, paradigm of training and teaching, especially for those of us who train in what we're kind of the symmetrical arts, you know, in the symmetrical training where we get in spar, you know, we're both ready, and that could take a long time to build that confidence. With these scenarios, again, every time someone taps into their confidence and really feels that, or taps into their power, there's a huge gain in their confidence. And that's what these scenarios do in a very quick and a very powerful way. And then it gets that successful response gets patterned into the subconscious, and then it's there, just like the proverbial victim remains a victim. Well, the proverbial champion now becomes a champion for the rest of their life.
That's an interesting dynamic. It's you know, it's the same kind of conditioning, the same kind of process that, like you described, even for yourself as a young boy going through, but now giving somebody the pathways and the ability to use that fuel to go down a more productive route for themselves. Back then, you know, or for anybody, sometimes it just takes one, maybe a couple of really challenging, traumatic situations for them to get that response. And in this case, when we talk about that freeze response ingrained into them, do you find there is some, I mean, I hate to say I'm looking for like kind of a magic number or a magic timeline for this, but like, does it take a few months? Does it take a couple of years? Is it something that you just got to keep on training on the other side of it as well? Or is it like, okay, well, if you do two or three of those trainings of yours, that you talk about, you're good. I mean, it's ingrained in you for the rest of your life. Well, what are your thoughts on that? And how do you approach that?
Yeah, I mean, more is always better, for sure. I think some people err on the over side, and some people err on the under side. Here's how I would answer that.
Yes,
having trained this in we've gone from. I mean, I've always worked in the context of seminars and workshops, and so the longest we've gone are 5 days, and we learned that was too much for adrenal stress training, because the adrenal, it's a real roller coaster when you're getting into the adrenal stress. And if you do too much, then you run the risk of adrenal burnout. And so what you want, there's a power curve where you want the training, you want to leave the training at your max power. If you go too far, and it's kind of back to the same thing in the scenario, you know, you don't want to push too far. You want to get the student to the max of their power curve, and then boom, you want to end the scenario. So it's the same thing in a training dynamic. We want to get the students to, you know, again, you're bracketing because you've got different people with different, you know, abilities, but you don't want to overdo it. But I found that in a few hours, you can get people a really good sense of the awareness components, what I call the ABCs, the awareness where, okay, awareness of predator-prey dynamics. What are they looking for? How not to be an easy victim. Don't be a soft target. Awareness of body mechanics, how important eye contact is, you know, all that. Awareness of the different types of situations that people get into. You know, is it a predatory situation where they want something from you? Is it a territorial where they want you out? Because both require a very different response. So get them aware of that, just some basic human dynamics, awareness of that. Awareness of breathing. You know, the first thing that happens when we get triggered and we hold our breath. Even martial artists do. Even though we ki-ai, martial artists hold their breath all the time when they get into a real fight.
Right.
You know, so anyway, just awareness of that. The B is the boundaries. To give them verbal tactics to de-escalate a situation. And then if that doesn't work, how to become like a cat cornered by a dog to just really communicate, you know, you better back off.
Yeah.
And that is probably the most important and most difficult thing for most people to do, because the whole verbal exchange, we don't get any training on that. And most of us get negative training on that in life, just in life in general. And then to flip their switch. So again, through a scenario, the first scenario that I would do with someone that I do in the 3 hours is very, very simple. Just to give you an idea of one example, if you have the predator armor, that's a great tool to really allow people to tap into their power.
Mm.
What I do is I have them stand, I teach them just basically jab them in the eyes, knee them in the nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty simple. And yes. They practice it against the pads. They don't do a lot of practicing, just to get the basic body mechanics. Mm-hmm. Then I have them stand there, close their eyes. I come up. So I'm setting up an asymmetric situation. So I'm not saying, okay, we're going to spar. You're going to be out of control. I will be in control. That's that asymmetric paradigm that predators use all the time on us.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so I'll come up and I'll grab them and I will be activated. I will be adrenally activated because I want to activate their adrenaline. So I'm going to come up and really activate your adrenaline.
Mm.
That's when you open your eyes and the coach is right there just going, yell, yell. And then the student, and you'll see invariably, it's pretty, pretty cool stuff. I can see it from the helmet. I will see the students when I grab them, they'll open their eyes will be as big as the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, holy crap. And what will happen is there will be an infinitesimal pause as they see what's happening. This part of the brain shuts down. This is how the training kicks in.
Yeah.
The amygdala, primitive survival instinct, the amygdala kicks in, and all of a sudden they go, and there's the coach yelling, you know, yell, get them to yell, and they're gonna break that spell.
Yes.
And then they go, and it's like unleashing the Tasmanian devil, where all of a sudden they're not conscious. They're that, in that adrenaline state. And you can get that in one scenario, just one experience. Every time someone taps into their power in a positive way, it increases their confidence hugely. On a no BS subconscious, you know, not a cocky bravado, but on a real deep level, wow, I did that for myself.
Mm.
You know, and then that builds the foundation to then build. So in the basics level, we do a 3-hour course and we go through those A's, the A, the B, the C.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, then they can continue on. They can do, it's modularized. They can do defense against armed assailants, ground fighting, multiple assailants, but it's all done in these, as I do it, in these modules. That said, there are many people who have been doing this training for decades now who do it on an ongoing basis within their dojo environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if that answered your question. I guess it doesn't take a long time to get the foundation built.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there you can build on it and take it to some pretty amazing places, really.
The primary thing that you're looking to activate is that once you get that adrenal response is to be able to direct it in specific ways. And it sounds like, you know, the more they can get that, that's primary. And then ultimately, if there are other scenarios, if there are other things that you'd be able to add to, like kind of giving them, instead of just one road to go down, they have like multiple roads to go down after they've found that fuel for themselves, then that's better than, you know, it's better to give them options, I suppose.
Yeah. And I'd say, I think you had said it really well. It is primary.
Mm.
One thing we can count on when we get into even a verbal assault is we're going to be adrenalized.
Mm.
And in my experience, the key determining factor in how the situation turns out is our ability to control the adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
Will we control it or will it control us?
Mm.
And for most of us without proper training, the adrenaline usually controls us. Even with Marine Corps training, you know, I still had that deep hardwired freeze response.
Mm.
And so, you know, that it's the adrenaline. And the key thing is, again, adrenaline is our friend.
Mm.
It's allowed us to survive in crazy situations. Mm. And it's learning to control that versus it controlling us that I think is the key to any altercation.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that I love that you say just that adrenaline is your friend. And I don't know why the imagery came up for me of Pulp Fiction, the wolf, Harvey Keitel's character. He comes in and he's there to help clean up the mess, yeah. Right? But the way that John Travolta, you know, is responding to him is like, well, wait a minute, man. Like, you know, how does this work and all that kind of thing. He's like, well, no. I'm here to help you, right? That's just the way it works. It goes from there. So don't be resistant to it. And I think that's the thing is like, you know, getting to a point where you understand, hey, this is how adrenaline, the helper, introduces itself to you, right? It may not be the way that you're expecting, like, oh, it's, you know, it feels all great and rainbows and stuff. I'm here to save you. It's like, hey, I'm here now, right? So getting the familiarity with how your body responds is a huge portion of this, so that you're able to like accept it as something that is more welcome than it is to be feared.
And you said the key word, and you said accept it. Mm. And that's it. It's going to be there regardless. And so if once when we accept it, well, then we have the possibility to learn to work with it. Mm. If we don't accept it, if we fight it, we deny it, we pretend it's not there, and we do, then it's really in control of us. It's taken over already. Mm. And so, yeah, it's the person who can control that that's going to have the upper hand for sure. And there's just one point on that.
Yeah.
Is when we get triggered, so there's intuition, right? We all have intuition. Mm-hmm. When we get triggered into that amygdala, into that fight or flight response, if we're not in control of that, we lose contact with our intuition, that innate intelligence that we all have inside us. And also that those little voices that just say, hey, you know, this is, you go do this or do this, where you're not so much conscious of it. It just kind of happens spontaneously. But if the adrenaline is in control and we're either freezing or in, I call it fight. It's kind of we're either aggressive or passive. That's how we lose control to the adrenaline. Ah, or freezing. Mm. When we're caught in that mode, we lose our intuition. We lose our innate sense. Mm. But when we're in control of it, not make it go away. That's so important. Mm. We're not making it go away. We're accepting that it's here, even embracing it and going, this is a beautiful survival response. Mm. And then we can learn how to use it as an incredible source of power if we need it.
Mm. That's great. I wanted to, you touched on it a little bit earlier, as far as generally how women and men react to certain challenges, situations. When it comes to self-defense for women, do you approach it in a different way than you do for men? No, I know that you have both in your groups, but as far as like, are there special considerations that you have, or you talk to your trainers about having some sensitivities when you're dealing with men or women?
Yeah, one, as far as the actual course, I teach them pretty much the same, because the dynamics that get us into trouble about getting fear and not dealing with the fear effectively is across the board. We all do it. And so we can all, you know, we all benefit from learning how to control that and work with it. I think the key thing with women is that we need to be, as men working with women, we need to be very cognizant of potential triggers. You never know what's going to trigger someone. And I wrote an article, this is boy back in 2000, for a martial arts magazine around, you know, how many we as male martial arts instructors have no idea how many female students we've lost. You know, well-meaning, I mean, we're good big-hearted guys, but how many students we've lost because maybe we put a woman up with some young buck, you know, an 18-year-old brown belt who's looking to prove himself. And maybe she has she's never talked about her history of abuse or something. And all of a sudden he gets in and he triggers her. Or with a lot of the grappling, you know, grappling is a very, what's the word I'm looking for? Grappling is great. We love it. Yeah. But it can be traumatizing for a woman who's experienced a situation. It's very vulnerable. You're in a very vulnerable situation. Mm. You know, and how many students, again, have gotten, whether it's grappling or stand up or whatever, have gotten into something where they're in over their head, they get triggered, and then they didn't fight their way out of it. And next thing you know, they didn't show up the next week and you never see them again. So I think especially when you're dealing with the adrenal stress, we need to be very conscious and careful with how we deal with them, how we create the scenario, how we talk about situations, and I think it's really important to learn to learn how to be real sensitive to women's issues. I think the more educated we can be, certainly the better. Mm. You know? So, but to get back to the as far as training, I find that it's still the same thing. I put them through the same process. I think it's awesome to have men and women training together because we get to see that we're actually a whole lot more alike than we are different, you know, I was talking to someone, a woman recently, who said, well, men should never teach women self-defense, which was a little hard to swallow for as a guy who's been teaching women self-defense for 30 years and kind of got some awards around that stuff and all, and maybe she knows better than I do, and she's a wonderful person, but I think that's that kind of the mindset out there that we're all, and we need to learn how to work together. We need to learn how to live together. So yeah, I as far as the process, I take them through the same process. But what happens is that in the actual scenario, then you can customize it. Mm. You can tweak it. Like, for example, a lot of women, the majority of women who are attacked are attacked by somebody that they know. Mm. And so that's a whole different scenario than some goon coming up and threatening to kill you out in a dark alley or something like that. And so in the actual scenario, a good instructor team can tweak the scenarios to be really, really relevant, even more relevant to maybe a woman versus a man or vice versa.
I think a lot of the things that you're talking about, particularly when it comes to the training and the team that's involved in the training, I mean, to your point, it's not just that these people are okay. They're just the bad guy. They're just going to do what they're going to do. Those folks have to have a sensitivity, really high sensory acuity to what's going on as well. So they can guide the student in a way that's going to not only challenge them, but also to make sure that they get a positive experience out of it as well. Is that something that you spend a lot of time on with the people that you work with, is just making sure that they do have that acuity and understand that they have a specific role to play with that?
Absolutely. Mm. It's a very unique and different training paradigm that we're doing. Mm. And so when we train, we're not only just in the scenarios, but we work on creating an overall sensitivity, creating a connected unit, so that there's a sense of connection, really, where the students feel like you're there for them. Number one, you are there for them, and the students really feel that. But when you're going to take them to this level of intensity, even in the context of a martial arts class, okay, we're going to do a scenario now, everybody. It's scary. It's vulnerable. And so, yeah, the more aware the instructors can be as to just the human dynamics of fear and, getting triggers. Hmm. Triggers is a whole huge thing that every martial artist, everybody needs to understand. You don't know what's going to trigger someone. Mm. Now, I was teaching a women's self-defense course, and there was a woman sitting next to me, and we started in a circle. We were just kind of introducing ourselves. And I could tell that she was just like, she was really on edge. And when we got to her, bless her heart, she just said, I'm really freaking out right now. Wow. And even just sitting next to a man is triggering the crap out of me. Wow. And then she went on to divulge that she had a history, a horrible history and all that. And so, yeah, we need to be cognizant of that. Even in just training, day to day with our martial arts students, you never know what's going to trigger someone. So the more sensitivity, the more awareness you have, and it's not, I mean, we don't need to be therapists. This isn't therapy, but it's a very, very therapeutic, but just show you care.
Yeah.
Just be empathetic. Show you care. Get away from the good old boy. I grew up in the good old boy, backyard dojo, dungeon dojo environment where it's like, yeah, you suck it up, dude. And how many? There weren't many women that trained back then.
No. And even the guys are there. A lot of them didn't last very long either.
And the guys. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was too much for most all of them. So yeah, I think just be empathetic, be open-hearted, really care about your students, and your intuitive ability is gonna come up and take care of most stuff before it even goes bad.
Yeah, I think that's something it's really important, because it's kind of like anybody that opens their own business. Like, they're really good at something, and then they open up for business. Like, oh,
you mean I have to be, I can't just be good at my craft. I have to be good at doing business as well. I have to do marketing and that type of thing. The same type of thing here in terms of like, you know, saying that, yeah, we're going to learn martial arts and you're including self-defense in there as well. Is that there's more to it than just the techniques, right? You know, some people just go, oh yeah, you know, I've learned all these techniques. I want to share these techniques, but it's especially these days. It sounds like you got to have more of that sensitivity, you know, like more consciously than just saying, okay, yeah, we'll show you this curriculum kind of a thing.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I think it's definitely a new era. Well, especially with children as a kind of the bread and butter in the martial arts where we really need to be sensitive. But I think just in general, I think we've learned a lot from the old days, you know, there's two sides of the coin. Back in the old days, it was like, self-defense. Yeah. It's self-defense. We're getting there. You survive a couple classes. You're learning self-defense. You know, I mean, we weren't learning all the verbal and the, you know, de-escalation skills back then, but certainly if we got into a fight, we usually did pretty well.
Yeah.
And, but those are the ones that survived the training. And how many of us are now getting hip replacements and knee replacements and brain replacements because of all the hard knocks we took. Right. Now it's a lot safer, you know. There's a lot more focus on the other positive attributes of the martial arts: the character development, the self discipline, the connection, you know, interpersonal connection, all that. But so self defense now is perhaps more relevant with martial arts because we're not getting in there and beating the crap out of each other. Mm. We're softening it to be safe. And so the need for I think there is a need, kind of a missing link in a lot of the martial arts training now, to get that hardcore. How can we do that? And with this training, we can do that. We can take them to that level without sending them out to the bars or without busting their heads in classes and losing students and all that.
As you look back now at whether it's just the things that we're talking about now or even beyond that, you know, with all of your experience and, you know, working with people and even just on your own journey, what, if you could pull out like one thing that was like the biggest lesson, that you got out of that, what would it be? What is there something that stands out for you?
From my martial arts training, you say?
Just in general. I mean, just something that you've learned. Maybe it was a mistake you made. It's like, oh, that was a lesson. Or just something that you'd kind of discovered, like, wow, that was profound, and you know, I'm running with that.
Yeah, and it was breathing. Breathing. It seems so simple, and you would think, you know, you think we'd be pretty good at breathing at this point. We kind of suck at breathing, especially when we get tense. But I think for me, that was a game changer. When I learned first why I was freezing up, because I would get triggered and my breathing would get real impeded. And then what that does is that's telling the brain fight or flight. It's just exacerbating the whole fight or flight response. The antidote is then a big, deep breath. The big deep breath. So the whole idea and the breathing goes along with the other paradigm shift. It was the adrenaline is our friend. Fear is our friend. I mean, what a color. If somebody would have taught me that or just told me that when I was a young kid, it would have changed my life. Instead, I was running from it. So I guess, I guess even more core than breathing is that fear is our friend. And it's an incredible resource. You know, it's there for a reason. But we need to learn how to control it or it's going to control us. And unfortunately, without proper training, oftentimes the fear is going to work against us because we just don't know any better.
To your point, I mean, like, you know, you say, okay, we learn to control fear. I think a lot of people say, well, yeah, that's what we're learning to do is we hear about fear and controlling it. But I think in that sense, in contrast to what you're talking about, I think the control of fear that most people learn is how to contain it, you know, or how to compartmentalize it and just, okay, that's that. Let me just keep on doing what I'm going to do it. The fear is there, sure. But you're talking about using it as really as a tool and a friend and something that you shouldn't put away, you shouldn't ignore at all.
Yeah. Look at, and I think you hit it. That's a really powerful distinction you made. So look at animals.
Mm.
So when a deer, you know, when a mountain lion goes after a deer, sure, that deer is, it's adrenalized, it's free, it's in full flight mode, because it doesn't know how to fight. So it's in full flight mode. And it does, it, that adrenaline is there and it responds and it, you know, and it reacts.
Mm.
Then if it survives and the mountain lion's gone, it goes right back. It just goes right back to eating. No drama, no trauma. Right. And what we do is unfortunately we get, you know, it affects us a lot differently. We get all caught up in it. So for me, what I do is when I say I accept the fear, it's like, dude, it's a difference between I ain't afraid,
which
is that cocky bravado. It's a bunch of bluffs, you know, versus, dude, you're scaring me and you better stop now.
Mm.
You know, there's a whole different internal phenomena going on there.
Mm.
And it's through the breathing. The way you control the breath is you just keep breathing out. that's gonna go the negative way. Or, dude, you're scaring me.
Mm-hmm.
You better, you know, and now I'm in control. And I guess here's another example. People, because I've been doing this suit, this crazy body armor work for so long, they go, do you still get adrenalized when you go up against the guy in the suit? And I go, heck yeah, I get adrenalized because I want to get adrenalized.
Mm.
If I'm going to have to fight, I want that adrenaline. I want every bit of jet fuel I can. And so the sensation of it is I'm standing there. So say that simple scenario with the eyes and the knees. So I'm standing there with my eyes closed and I know the guy's going to come up and of course they're going to give me extra love because I usually give them extra love too,
sure. You know,
but I know they're going to hit me hard. And so, you know, I'm going, oh crap, oh crap, oh crap. And so what I do is I breathe, I take a big deep breath and it feels like someone opening a spigot of warm water and it just floods through my whole body. So, and that's fear and adrenaline. But it's beautiful fear and adrenaline. It's like, it feels great and it's there. Now I could just walk away and just let it all dissipate.
Mm.
Or if, you know, when that guy grabs me, I can use that. And so I'm already at 90%, but I'm harnessing it. I'm in control of it. And then it's just a matter of flipping that switch to that next 10%.
Mm.
And so, yeah, it's people think I'm supposed to make it go away.
Yeah.
You know, right now there's a quote going around on the internet, which is beautiful, an old Bruce Lee quote, which says basically, you know, in a situation, stay calm and cool and you know, don't knee jerk it and all that. I think that's true. But I think most importantly, it says, don't be emotional, be rational.
Mm.
And I think what he's saying there is don't emotionally knee jerk in the situation.
Mm.
But stay calm and cool. But that doesn't mean that you're not having your adrenaline there.
Mm.
Now that kind of, what scares me about that is that it kind of pushes that old Clint Eastwood, you know, cool
right.
and calm and cold as ice.
Right.
And not that way. We're human beings. We're going to have these responses. And so the more we can accept them and work with them, the better. Not make the fear go away, but go, yeah, I'm afraid. And to go from there.
Yeah. And I keep on getting this this imagery of, like, you know, you get this fear, a lot of people will just kind of throw it into the cellar, right? And then just keep on going that way. But the cellar is only so big. It can only contain so much until it comes out in a way that you probably didn't want, as opposed to what you're talking about here is like, hey, don't put it away. Just experience it and let it play itself out in a way that you can direct. And that's going to be much more positive in any case.
Yeah. I think another piece that people don't get is that you can be really calm and cool and smart while you're really scared.
Mm.
But it's all, again, keeping the brain online, keeping this part of the brain so that, yeah, I'm scared, but how do I want to deal with this situation versus that fear triggers us into those emotional knee-jerk responses where all of a sudden we're out of control. We're out of control with this, and we're likely going to be out of control with what's triggering it.
Hmm. Bill Kipp, this was awesome. Yeah, I could talk to you for hours, man. But listen, I think the people that find their way to this and listening to you, they're probably going to want more of you. Where could they do that?
You can find me at predatorarmor.com. And armor is spelled kind of Under Armour way, the European way. And there you can find, you can contact me there. I'm actually, I've taken a break. Fast Defense was my love and joy for decades. And then a few years ago, I handed that off to a cool team. You can go to fastdefenseglobal.org and find out about the training. They're all, every one of the instructors there I personally trained, and they're continuing it on. They've created a nonprofit and they're doing great work. For me, I felt a different calling. And I've been doing some other work, and now I'm really focusing on kind of this concept about, you know, what we need in the world is we need people to have strong hearts. And what I mean by that is when you close your heart to protect it, you're actually making it weaker. You never make your heart weaker by closing it. And I think that's what we do. When the fear hits, we close it and we're making it weaker and weaker. Conversely, every time we feel that adrenaline and we tap into our power, it makes our heart stronger and stronger. And the great example is Chuck Norris. You know, I mean, yeah, we look at Chuck as, oh, the big bad guy. We have all the jokes about Chuck and all that. But really what he is he's the guy that could walk away from a fight. You know, that's how we really kind of looked at him initially before all the jokes came out. Now, this guy had the strength of heart to be in a situation and have the empathy to go, no, I'm not going to fight you. You know, you're having a bad day. I'm going to walk away. And that's having a strong heart. And I think the drills that we do, the adrenal stress training very quickly, and this is why I think it's such a beautiful missing link in the martial arts, is it gives people through these adrenal stress games, I'm calling them, not even fighting, just games where they can tap into their power and feel it. And so right now I'm working on a new evolution of courses called Strong Heart Games. And I'm going to actually roll it out at Master Dave Kovar's conference here in May in Denver. But that's what intrigues me. You know, the fighting, I'm kind of, you know, fighting is fighting, but what really gets me is when people can tap in, open their hearts and really feel, you know, I say no so that I can say yes to life. And that's a beautiful thing. So that's kind of where I'm at now these days.
That's fantastic. Well, I mean, I can't wait to learn more about that. And yeah, it just sounds amazing to me. But thank you again so much for being on with us.
Hey, my pleasure, buddy. I've been watching you. You do great work. I feel blessed and honored to be amongst the people you've had on.
Folks, I hope you appreciated that chat with Bill. He's just such a gracious person. I was really appreciative of his openness in, you know, sharing the traumas that he's had in the past, but even more so, just his direction in where he's going with kind of his mission now. That is it for this episode. This is Philip with the Everyday Fighter Podcast. Talk to you next time.